Do you want to talk about some of your courses?
Okay.
Okay. There was the course Becoming American, so that's what we're doing. But before we do that, let's start. When you first got here, can you tell us about your workload, what your course load was?
Yeah.
For each semester? And some of the courses you taught?
Yeah. Basically, three courses. See, I was hired as a statistician. Statistics was one of the three required courses for sociology majors. And so I had it made. As long as we had a large number of sociology concentrators, you know, we had warm bodies. I got good training at Chapel Hill in statistics. I think all along in statistics and in other courses, I think I tried to live up to the expectation that to be a William Mary faculty member, you had to be tough. Work, load, and tough examinations.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I remained that. Even as I think during the last years leading up to 2002 when I retired, I think for the last 10 years or so in that time period, I think the grading became more lax, and I think we hired some younger faculty who were more lax in their grading, and I just remained tough. One of my daughters, I went to UVA, as in, two of them actually, but one of them said she had talked to someone who was transferred from William Mary to UVA,
uh-huh.
and she found out that I was her father,
uh-huh.
and said, "Boy, your dad was tough." And then there's somebody who's a high school teacher in the local public school system. And he says, "Boy, you were tough." You know, so, you know, I had that kind of reputation. But, and I think part of it is overcompensation for what I thought was, in a way, a deprivation in terms of upbringing. And I felt that, you know, I'm teaching mostly kids who came from homes who are much more privileged than myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of had to, I felt all along that I had to give my best to them and to give them, you know, tough materials to deal with and to take seriously and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you wear that with pride, though, that you were a tough professor, or?
Yeah, and that was true with my graduate students. I remember this one man who was a father of three children, came here as a graduate student from VCU, and right off the bat, you know, at that level especially, you know, paper assignments were rigorous and frequent. And he came into my office and he was bawling. He says, "I'm not used to this."
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I had the same experience with several other graduate students, literally weeping because, you know, the red remarks and all that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they were just crushed, you know. And, but I think the happy thing is once they've gone through the hoops, you know, and they've graduated, sometimes they've gone on to PhD programs,
mm-hmm.
they say, "Hey, that was great." You know, I remember one guy who went to University of Kentucky for his PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote back and he says, "You know your graduate course in sociological theory?" He said, the graduate course here at Kentucky was a piece of cake. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to talk about some of your other courses then?
Let me talk about, let's see, then the routine kinds of things.
Yes.
Okay, let me tell you about how I got into teaching Blacks in American Society.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman who was an adjunct professor, and she was able to get a position elsewhere, and there was that class sitting there. So I took it over. I didn't want to get trapped teaching only statistics
and
introductory sociology.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically as people left, I said, oh yeah, my dissertation was on sociology of education. So when that person left, I says, I want to teach that.
Mm-hmm.
So I expanded that and so forth. Okay, let me, I also taught population studies. And then I'm going to leap over to the early 1990s. We had arts and sciences. We had curriculum review.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when area sequence came into being. You know, and there were a number of ideas in there, such as, we're a changing world, you know? There is a world outside of the lower 48 plus Hawaii and Alaska. And so we had Caribbean studies being born, and eventually East Asian, you know, and of course European studies, etc. So that was, and then the other thing, personally, I says, how can I fit in with this new jazzed up curriculum that's looking at the world outside of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I says, aha. Okay, over the last several years, you know, we're finding more and more non-traditional white Americans coming to William Mary. They're coming from Korea, and they're coming from Nigeria, and they're coming from Brazil, and some from Iceland and other places. And that's when I said, well, okay, I'm gonna try to carve out something that is a blend of the outside and the U.S., and I saw it through the children of immigrants and their parents since 1965. And so I designed this course called Becoming Americans. And I would try to say a little bit about the major groups. And I'd start off with Native Americans, because they're a group about whom a lot of people don't know very much.
Okay.
You know, and then Latin American, Asian American, and then I had some optional ones depending on the composition of the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I had developed kind of specialty area groups. And then they would prepare and make oral presentations in class. And, you know, one time, it was kind of weird, probably weird to me, but maybe not weird to the students. They were students from Vietnam. They probably had talked to each other about taking class together or something. Okay, and that's how we got enough of a critical mass to develop course there.
Mm-hmm.
Another unusual one was having to do with Arab Americans. Okay, again, something similar happening, etc. Indian, East Asian American Indians, that kind of thing. And then I was involved with Christopher Wren beginning in the early 1990s. And so we have several forces coming together. Wayne Cornot, mm-hmm. who was chair of the department in 1965 when he hired me, he and his wife also started this thing called Christopher Wren Association for Senior Citizens. And I was captive because I was in the department. And he said, it's 1992. And he says, do you know anything about the Japanese Americans who were in the concentration camps during World War II? I says, yeah. And so, you know, I started collecting films and articles and things of that sort. And so I taught a Christopher Wren course on Japanese Americans and the internment experience. Did that a couple times.
Did he know you had been in a camp as a child?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he was asking if, if you knew about kind of academic documentary material, that sort of thing.
Right.
Okay.
And I continue to collect a lot of stuff.
Okay.
There's another Japanese American who's 15 years older than I am, and I'm glad that he's still alive. His, coincidentally, he came from the same part of Southern California that our family came from, although we didn't know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he went into U.S. Army in 1945, and then he went into Foreign Service. That was his career.
Okay.
And so we collaborate, shared information, and so on. So we have quite a bit of information together on Japanese Americans.
And I'm sorry, is he someone you met through the Christopher Wren Association? Is that right? Or
Let me see, how did I heard about him and I said, would you be interested in co-teaching this
mm-hmm.
course?
So he's here.
Yeah, and then he and I have collaborated on giving talks, you know, in
mm-hmm.
Newport News, that kind of thing. Now, later on, you know, they come knocking on my door again
mm-hmm.
and saying, well, is there something else that you'd be interested in teaching? And so as 2002 and retirement was approaching, I came up with what I thought was natural, and that's contemporary immigrants. A course on immigrants coming basically after 1970 to the United States. And I make it, I have three parts, basically historical, legal, that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
kind of taking in immigration up to 1924, and then the changes made in 1964. And then what I do is I, in the last 2 hours session, I focus on the future. And I basically had a teasing question. I said, are brown Americans going to become real Americans? And then I go through a number of assimilation theories and
mm-hmm.
examples.
Okay.
So, you know, that was an exciting thing to teach. More and more, you know, I had to say something about illegal immigration
mm-hmm.
And to work with that. Made some people mad.
Yes.
They would just get up and leave, you know. You know, but I had, you know, with my demography kind of background, I just had tons of
mm-hmm.
information. You know, and I would say things like, Did you know that in Silicon Valley, 40% of the new high-tech firms being established in Silicon Valley, California, were established by immigrants, largely from China and India. Mm-hmm. And did you know this and that, and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
And then I do a gradient, you know, I said, well, you know, just because one's an immigrant doesn't promise success
right.
in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
People come with different gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Some from India come with their MD degrees in hand. Their lives are pretty good here in the United States once they come here. The people from Cambodia may have a very different kind of experience.
Right.
You know, they were people, many of whose relatives were killed, you know, in the early 1970s, et cetera. And you had the Hmong people.
Mm-hmm.
The Hmong people had been illiterate all these years.
For centuries.
For centuries.
Yeah.
And they come to Minnesota. And it's the first time that their children, born here in the United States, or having come here as youngsters, have exposure to a formal education,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, you know, you have gradients within each national or origin group, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've received pretty good responses, you know, by and large from people. The good thing about teaching Christopher Wren is you don't have any exams to grade.
So there's no bitter, no bitterness over grades from anyone.
And then the other thing is you're talking about grown-ups. And some of these grown-ups have come, in fact, to the United States as immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or have a sister-in-law who happens to be from Philippines or something.
Right.
You know, some life experiences,
right.
you know, that feed the conversation.
Okay. So let's just jump back to your classes. Can you compare your course load when you first came to Langley versus what it was like? And obviously, you know, realizing later in your career, course loads change. But can you do a little comparison of that first, what you remember?
Yeah. One of the things I remember my first year, first time I taught the statistics course, there were 52 students
mm-hmm.
in the class. And I had to run three labs
mm-hmm.
In addition, and then taught an introductory sociology course. So, pretty burdensome load. Typical load was three courses a semester. Some in modern languages said, you have it easy, we have four classes to teach, you know. And then in other departments, they had already come to the norm of teaching two classes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we thought, wow, aren't they lucky, you know.
Yeah.
From 65 to 68, teach only undergraduate students mixed. From 1968 to early 90s, something like that, whenever a number of MA programs disappeared
mm-hmm.
because of financial reasons, etc. I taught a greater variety of courses because I was, during the 1980s, because I was director of the graduate program, I had a two-course load.
Okay.
The 1990s were exciting because of curricular changes. We had more interdisciplinary courses.
Mm-hmm.
One I enjoyed teaching was on the course on the 60s. And what was fun about that is that the faculty would get together once a week and we go through the curriculum. We had the same curriculum,
uh-huh.
And we'd talk about major themes, questions, and so on. And we'd, and there was usually a movie, like one night a week, Wednesday night or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it was in a large room, so we had hundreds of students coming together to mm-hmm. see a movie on Vietnam or a fictional work that was mm-hmm. related to the topic for the week, that okay. kind of thing. So that was exciting. And then the through the Black Studies program, again, I kind of suggested before that I think some of the interdisciplinary classes, I think, came to be defined as fluff, you know, not real academic, you know, and so on. And that was kind of a problem that women's studies and Black studies had. But, you know, we were determined as an interdisciplinary faculty to, you know, make sure that our classes were rigorous
mm-hmm.
And that they were well subscribed, etc. And my Black studies courses were well subscribed. For the most part, and that was true of, you know, other programs, other courses in American history, literature, dance, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, in 1990s, I think because of the new curriculum and this interdisciplinary nature, in some ways, it was a return to what brought me happiness in the 1960s, you know, because we had the opportunity to work together across disciplines,
mm-hmm.
you know, and make friendships also in the process. So that's fun. And when I retired in 2002, I felt positive. And I think relative to a number of others who came from maybe more middle-class backgrounds and so on, for whatever reasons, you know, they were looking for retirement
mm-hmm.
Because they were, sometimes they felt that they weren't appreciated, I suppose, you know, their work. Sometimes they just became tired of the additional work,
mm-hmm. and
committee work, in addition to, you know, teaching and so forth. And there were times when, as in the early 2000s, you know, when the economy had slow time,
mm-hmm.
you know, and disenchantment over, oh gosh, no salary increase next year, or the salary increase is, you know, going to be delayed until November of two years from now, whatever, and
we don't even have
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I always felt privileged. You know, I mean, what a life working with some of the brightest nicest college students you can find anywhere in the United States. You know, nice community, nice college, nice colleagues. You know. What a life. So, but at the same time in 2002, you know, some people say, if you were happy doing what you were doing, why didn't you continue?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a strong ethical sense that there are lots of PhDs, very talented young PhDs out there looking for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a good run, I'm happy, and I'd like to have openings for them. Really felt that way, feel that way still. I mean, sometimes I would say, that person is still teaching, 74 years old, you know. That person is selfish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I also came to understand by talking to some of these folks that I think some really were fearful that they would die because they didn't have anything to do, you know. And you know, you have a sense for my volunteerism, and that's kept me committed, you know, and kind of connected to a larger community. At the same time, my wife and I, neither one of us had traveled very much except domestically.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've used the opportunity to see the world, you know, and it's been a luxury to have that opportunity. Then one other thing is since last October, and you know, our economic situation, and I think we at William Mary sometimes, faculty and staff, sometimes feel we're underpaid, you know, that kind of thing. And for 7 years now, I've been getting VRS payments. Been getting Social Security, and guess what? You have cost of living associated with each one. And so, with hindsight, again, I feel not bad. You know,
mm-hmm.
if one were in the private sector, your medical plan, your retirement plan could be in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I said, even that's good.
Okay, let's kind of tie up your college terms. Is there anything you want to say about any particular professors you worked with while you were here at the college? Anecdotes or stories, or
well, I think
you mentioned a few people.
Yeah,
but.
I think generally, well, I can say a lot about Gary Krebs and David Day and myself. I think we each felt early on that we were underdogs.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Krebs's dad was somewhat like my dad. He was a groundskeeper,
mm-hmm.
and my father was a farm laborer, became gardener. And David Day's father was a small town baker. And I think each of us felt several things. One is, we're college professors now, you know, and we felt proud of our achievements,
mm-hmm.
And we felt that, you know, we were living a better life in a lot of ways, a richer life than our parents, you know, and we've been optimistic, I think, and thankful.
Right.
For that fact. And, you know, and then we have in our department, in sociology and in other departments, faculty members who grew up privileged and in materially comfortable homes and surroundings and so on, and found the William Mary faculty salary kind of wanting in terms of, you know, the lifestyle they were used to, that kind of thing. And so they're kind of in my other category, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they
should be
experience.
They should really be more grateful for what they have than to be surpluses.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I have friends who are sometimes kind of on the margins, for whatever reasons, okay? And I'm not going to name names this time, but mention people with whom I've had long friendships. A couple of faculty members are homosexual males. And I think it's my kind of open readiness to be with them and to, you know, share time with them and so on that I think is appreciated, reciprocated, that kind of thing. Another kind of margins is among faculty members of immigrant background. And I think because of accents or because of physical appearance, again, I get along with them. You know, and then, of course, I get along with another marginalized group, and that's the African-American faculty members and administrators. But most of my faculty friends are normal.
Normal.
Yeah.
Well, that's quotes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to ask, though, about some of those marginalized groups you just mentioned. Do you have the sense, and obviously this changed over the course of your years at William & Mary, but that the William & Mary community, let's just call it that, faculty, staff, students, was not as welcoming to, think about the case of gay men. Was it a matter of, you know, just being closeted, or was there out and out, you know, discrimination or kind of alienation?
I think.
And then we could go. I mean, we could go through, you know,
yeah,
any group
I,
we wanted
yeah,
to with that. And so
yeah,
feel free to elaborate on specific groups.
I think
or
when,
generally.
Yeah, I think in terms of impressions that people in higher education have of William & Mary, I think. I think we've had the reputation for being relatively receptive to homosexual men and women, and at the undergraduate level too. I think folks were more ready to be open, I think, here at William & Mary, and this includes students as well as faculty members, than at a number of other places.
And is that based on your impression or conversations with other people?
Yeah, both.